There's a harshness to children's logic. It's hard for us to grasp. It's very ferocious and fierce. And what is bad should be burned and killed, so that when Snow White's stepmother has to wear iron shoes at the end, we shudder. It's a terrible thing to do to her, but they're saying, good, good. Because she's terribly bad. And she deserves a terribly bad ending. And the juniper tree is full of these almost pious but just orders. And all at the same time, it's extremely beautiful. The evocation is beautiful. The imagery is beautiful. So it has all of those elements, which I think make a great story. Not a great children's story, a great story, period.
Yeah.
There's a tradition of illustrated books for adults
that
recently has stopped happening. Has that been something that's occurred to you?
I've been asked to illustrate books for adults, but I'm not interested in doing it. I don't see why it needs them. But that's a very, as you see, I'm very personal opinionated about a lot of things. But great writers, if they're great writers, really don't need illustrators. And talking earlier to somebody, because I had illustrated once a short story of Tolstoy's, which I loved very much, and it's a fiasco. Because Tolstoy is such a graphic writer. I mean, who doesn't know what Anna Karenina looks like? I mean, who has the audacity to draw her at this point? Only Greta Garbo got away with portraying her, because Greta Garbo is a kind of genius. But there are certain books, and my favorite writers, say, are Herman Melville or Henry James or Kafka. I love them, but I can't illustrate them. Because how dare you? How dare you draw Captain Ahab? Well, Kafka might, but I've got to be a lot older to try that. That's too risky. So, but then to just arbitrarily do pictures for adult books seems a conceit. It seems, at this day and age, artsy-craftsy. It doesn't seem as genuine as it did in the 19th century when Dickens was really illustrated by terrific illustrators. And Trollope was illustrated by terrific illustrators, and George Eliot was. But we don't, it's not a tradition with us. It doesn't make any sense. And we don't have Trollope's, George Eliot's, or Dickens, to put it mildly. Yeah.
Would you ever consider going back to the Broadway stage after going to such the heights of opera, after having done something like Sages?
Yeah.
Is that not as satisfying as your work?
It was satisfying. I don't think like opera is the heights and Broadway is the lows.
Well, I mean, just really, that you can have, it's a bigger canvas.
I wouldn't do a Broadway thing because obviously it's an act of suicide for working artists. Anyone I know who has tried has been such punishment that there is no gratification. If there is no gratification, even if you're a masochist, then why do it at all? And doing Really Rosie on Broadway was a very chastising experience. It was very hard. There was no money. And every day was an effort of, where do we get the money and how do we keep it going? We had bad reviews. We had one good review, which wasn't enough. She ran for a year. But troubles backstage, backbiting and bitching, and money, money, money. I'm not that interested in every day how to get the money to keep it going. I backed off the whole thing. That doesn't seem to me fun at all. I mean, whatever the trials and tribulations of publishing which I describe, it still is a marvelously beautiful art form which you can do by yourself at home. How many people can stay home and listen to crappy television and do books? You know, it's a rare privilege. So I'm really not knocking it. And also you're not consumed with financial distress. Or if you are, it's too bad. But it's not like doing a Broadway show.
And the opera is mostly subsidized.
The opera is mostly subsidized. The opera has a very small budget. We all know. Everybody comes in and they'll say, you know, it's a privilege to work for us. And I say, sure, sure, whatever you say. I mean, there's no money. We know that. So we don't expect money. So we just do it because... And I'm subsidized by my books. As long as my books continue to sell, I can afford to indulge myself and do opera designs because one doesn't get paid for opera very well at all. Yes?
Amy White once written that he changed from writing for adults to writing for kids because kids responded to his writing by writing to him. And I wondered if you had any kind of camaraderie like that with your readers, or kids write you letters, whether you enjoy that.
Yes, I don't know why he said that. I don't understand that. But to answer the second part of your question, yes, I have lots of correspondence with children, which is wonderful. It's the only way. You don't know what your book is all about from the reviews you read. Reviews are so bad, so fatuous, that you just dismiss them. Maybe except for English reviews, which always tend to be better and more interesting, even when they don't like your book. But it's the children who take the trouble to write. There it is. That's it. Now, that divides itself into two. You have the kids who really don't want to write at all, but they're told to write. So Mrs. Goldstein that morning writes on the bus, today we will write to our favorite illustrator. And they all write, today we'll write. And every letter is the same. And it's boring. And it's, dear Mr. Sendak, today Mrs. Goldstein said we should write to our favorite illustrator. You are my favorite illustrator. Could I have a free book? Could I have a glossy? Could I have a pint of your blood? They don't want this. They don't care. Mrs. Goldstein wants all this. Okay. Now, predominantly, the bulk of children's mail is this enforced writing that they have to do. But then there's like 40% of kids who just write, and that's pure gold, because they don't have to, and they write. And those letters I treasure. Not all of them, but some of them are just sensational. Some of them are very critical, like, your new book is disgusting, and I hope you die cordially. Now, that's a review you can't hardly live through. But then they really tell you what to... I'll tell you, may I give you an example, which is an extraordinary example, of a little girl who wrote from Toronto. Now, outside over there, just come out in England, and I guess they got the English edition in Canada. And she wrote and said, I'm paraphrasing, I can't do it exactly. I've always been a fan of yours, but you have disappointed me very, very much. And I am writing to tell you that you shouldn't do that to me. Because I have liked your books very much, but the goblins scare me too much, and I don't like that. Yours truly. Okay. Then, this went on for 5 pages, so I'm reducing. Next day, I had discussed what I wrote to my mother, and she asked me, did I really feel that way? And I said to her, yes, I do. Sincerely yours. Next page, she says, I was thinking about it a lot. And she said, and I wish a reviewer would give me this kind of logical fairness that she was giving me. She said, I thought about it a lot, and I thought, you never scared me before, then why would you scare me now? And then I thought, why am I so scared? She said, well, let me tell you what I'm scared of, because I don't think I've told you yet. I am scared of that the goblins have no faces. I don't like things that have no faces. But then I thought about it, and I thought about it, and now I know that I really shouldn't be scared, because the goblins are babies. And if you're a baby, you can't fit into the top part where your head is. So instead of being afraid of them, you should feel sorry for them. Now, she had worked through this whole evolution. Now, the tip-off to the whole thing was a tiny note that her mother slipped in before mailing the thing, saying, her daughter, we have just had a new arrival in the family. And a lot of this torturous self-questioning had to do with little purple-faced creature in the next room. Yeah. But they do write often very torturous, thought-out letters about what you're doing or what you're trying to do. Or they love it or they hate it. But they're very passionate letters. Like, marry me. I mean, just quick letters like that. And perhaps my favorite of all was a 3-year-old who couldn't write. And he drew me what he thought was a squiggle, but it was a terrific drawing. It was so terrific, I have it framed. It was an accident. Just a kid's accidental crayon drawing that turned out to be a little masterpiece. So I wrote him back saying, dear Danny, I think your drawing is fantastic. I framed it, blah, blah, blah. Of course, he couldn't write back. His mother wrote back, and she said, Danny liked your card so much, he ate it. It was the highest praise. Well, how much time do we have? In the night kitchen is, well, like outside over there, a great amalgam of a lot of things happening. I'll tell you about a few of them. One was, I was going to leave New York for health reasons. I had had a coronary 2 years before then, and I was not permitted to live in New York anymore. So it was adio New York, and it was going to be hard. So I wanted to, on a conscious level, do a book that was in praise of New York City. My New York book. So that's what Night Kitchen was going to be, because from childhood on, New York was the place you ate. It was where you didn't have to eat your mother's food. It was where you didn't have to be kosher. It's where your elder sister took you on the train with those marvelous smells as you crossed the river, big bakeries that used to be there, and me and my brother just zooped the smell in as we went by. Then you got there and you ate in these extravagant Oriental places with names like Schrafts, Longchamps, And then you went to Radio City Music Hall to see a Walt Disney movie, or you went to the Roxy to see Frank Sinatra or Judy Garland, and they were extravagant evenings, extravagant. And I remember the city as just being the most edible, luxuriant place in the world. And we went very infrequently because it was expensive to spend an evening. We had to get the money out of our parents. That was hard. And my sister had to be cajoled into doing it. So the book became a love letter to New York. Okay, on another level, it was a love letter to my favorite. I love the movies. Of all art forms, the movies next to comic books is what I grew up in. So, and King Kong was my favorite movie. I must have seen King Kong 300 times. I mean, I always see King Kong, where I see The Wizard of Oz, which is another favorite movie. But I wanted to do a movie that, one, involved New York and King Kong. And that great image of King Kong, we've heard too much about him of late, unfortunately, with the airplane going. So there was the milk bottle. So it was a composite. Laurel and Hardy were my favorite people in the whole world. And a lot of people were very angry that Stan was not in the book. Well, I'd be the first to know that, except I needed three fat bakers. I didn't need a skinny baker, so he couldn't have the part. So Ollie got all three parts in that book. And that's the only reason he's there, really, because I wanted him to be there. And on a perhaps sadder, clearly sadder level, was that both my parents were dying. And my mother died the year I started the book. I'd had the coronary, and my father started to die. It was one of those, we all have those moments in life where it all happens. And so the book turned out to be more than Goodbye New York, Goodbye Everybody. It's dedicated to my mother and father. And Mickey, at the very beginning, goes flashing, literally, past their door, where Mom and Pop are sleeping tight forever. So it's suddenly me being sick and worried and turned back into childhood. Because no matter how old you are, when your parents die, you're 2 years old. You are orphaned as a child. That's a great shock to think that when you're in your proper 40s or 50s, when you expect your parents to die. Well, nobody expects their parents to die, no matter when or how old you are, I discovered. And so I had to live through all the anxiety of being a child, losing my parents, even though I was far from being a child. So Night Kitchen became a kind of solution, maybe. Kind of triumph over a lot of things and a lot of troublesome things. It's a book I very much care for because of all the elements that went into it and because it has a libidinal viciousness, which I like too, which I let myself go free on. I mean, it's a very sensuous book which I indulged in. And I was not timid for a change. I just let myself do it. I didn't give a hang what they were going to say. Yeah. Yes, there was a Miss Jenny. She was my dog for 15 years. I think they have very morose stories to tell you. I'm sorry. But that book, too, was written because she was dying. And, you know, books become magic talismans. I guess a lot of artists must do this. We do it to hold on to things that we're losing. And Jenny, I was losing Jenny, and I wasn't about to do it. That's all. I lost her anyway. But the book, well, she had appeared in every book since I got her in 1952, and she died in 1967. And that was her final and her best book. She only had bit parts in all the other books. She's Max's dog and Wild Things. She's all over the place being chased. But Higgledy is her prima donna role, the best part she ever had. And I think it's, well, I like it, as I said earlier, it's my favorite because it's the only book I've written that's really funny. I'm not a funny, I'm a sort of, Frank Cossaro, the man I work with, calls me Moreau Sendak, not Maurice Sendak. And he has a point. I seem to drench a bit. But I think Higgledy is really, when I read it again, it's a funny book. I know it's sad in some ways, but the comicness of it gives me hope that someday I can write something else that's funny. Yeah.
I disagree with you. What about Pierre? I thought Pierre was
funny. I guess Pierre is funny. I never think of him. I think he's just such a strange kid.
Where did Pierre come from?
Where did Pierre come from? Oh, well, I can tell you, actually, from a very great grandiosity in me, because I was at the peak of my love of Herman Melville, okay? And I wanted to do a book that had the same title. There was no way you can do a book called Moby Dick, or even The Confidence Man, and you can look for the obscure things. Well, I finally decided on Pierre, because I love Pierre. And so that's the only reason there is such a book. And then I had to rhyme it, and the only thing I could think of was, I don't care. And that's the way books are written. Yeah.
What kind of a response do your books have in other countries?
Very different. Very different. The kind of controversy I have here never happens there. The fact that Mickey had genitals obviously bored everybody in Europe. I mean, it was just of no consequence whatsoever. Everyone has a different thing that gets them uptight, you know. I did a book called Some Swell Pup, which caused a lot of trouble here because the children are so raucous and noisy and cantankerous and mean, and that's not nice to set role models. I don't care about role models, so that's not my job. But the book got in trouble here because the kids were mean. It got in trouble in England because the dog defecated on the floor. So every country has its own little problem. England carries on about defecation, and they do. You can't worry about everybody's problem, clearly. But it is very different as you go from country to country to country. Yes, the translations on the whole are marvelous. The Germans are very literal. Sometimes the Japanese I will never know. But I do speak some German and some little French, so I can. But the German translations are very literal and correct, almost too correct sometimes. The French ignore you completely in the typical way that they would. They will invent the title. And I'll give you an example of two titles which are interesting for their showing up this particular quality. The German title of Where the Wild Things Are. They were so anxious to please me and keep the rhythm of the American title. So it's Wo die Wilden Curlen Wohnen. Which is okay, but it's not right. Because Curlen, you obviously speak German, is not, it's not wild things, it's more like rowdy man or bum. But what they were looking for was Where the Wild Things Are, Wo die Wilden Curlen Wohnen. See, they were desperate to get the meter right, but they lost the whole thing for the meter. Whereas the French couldn't have cared less. They didn't like the title. They always say that, oh, Monsieur Sende, we do not like your title, we hope you don't mind. But their title is ingenious. It's Max et les Maxi Monstres, which is wonderful, because it catches absolutely the title and ignores the meter completely. I can't read Spanish, so I don't know. I'll bring it in and show it to you. I don't know what the Spanish title is. Yeah.
Really Rosie is, among other things, about being famous.
Yeah.
And you have now appeared on the cover of the New York Times magazine.
True.
Are there
twice,
any,
I might
yes,
say.
Things that occur to you in the context of that whole phenomenon of being famous?
I mean, how do I feel about being famous?
Do you like it?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, yes, it sounds, I feel embarrassed because it's a coy, anything I say will sound sort of coyish, but I've enjoyed it. I also don't take it terribly seriously. I really don't. I have no affiliations with the establishment in New York. I don't know anybody like famous people. I don't go to the places that they go to eat or drink. It's not out of prudishness. I'm disinterested, really. But I like being well known. I enjoy what I've gotten from that. But I think I know what to do with it to give myself pleasure.
No problems getting rid of people?
No, I'm never recognized to my dismay. No problems getting rid of people. No, it's just not one of my problems. What can I tell you? Right.
You said when you wrote In the Night Kitchen that you weren't timid and you just put it all out. Were you timid in some of the other books?
Yeah, I was timid in some of the other books. I was very influenced by what I knew it would be what would be objected to. I had to have a certain weight, speaking of famous. One of the good of it is the weight you get in terms of they want to publish you, right? So where they wouldn't have tolerated something 5 years ago that you did, they'll print anything you do. It's very cynical and terrible, in fact, but you're the one that has to be moral and ethical about the work you do. If you're using publishers, all right, but use them for good reasons. Okay, so a certain timidity was natural to an artist who didn't have the weight, financial weight. You had to be careful. I mean, someone said belly was a bad word in 57, I would have taken it out, put in pupik or something else, but you had no choice. Yeah.
Edward Gorey was asked to do sets designs for Dracula, and it seemed like it was almost blown up illustrations that he had done. It seems like your interest in set design is very different from that. Are there visual similarities between the books that you've written and what it is you're designing for sets?
Somewhat. Not really, because I wouldn't want the sets to look like what I've illustrated. And yet, of course, there are bits and pieces of things that look to people like something they've seen in the book. I know Ed Gorey. We talked about that, and I was a little angry with him because he did let them just blow those drawings up. And there is something that should happen in between rather than just blowing up the drawings. Because set designs shouldn't be just blown up drawings. You got to know what... Yeah, you want to say something.
Yeah. Are you executing the designs yourself?
No, but I am with the people who are executing the designs. And I have apprenticed myself to the scenic painters who are painting the things. Now, there is a group of... a studio in Montreal who painted the Magic Flute and the other sets that I've done. And every opera I do now, I beseech the opera company to use these people because I have a hang on them and they have a hang on me. We know what we're doing. They also let me come to the studio in Montreal. They let me paint. So I've been, in 2 years, been learning how to execute with a very large brush, huge strokes. I do it very badly, but then I'm not trained and eventually I'll get a little better. But there's such, it's like worrying about when you've finished the book, and I always warn my students who are illustrators, you must put in your contract that you're going to the printer. Come hell or high water, you insist, because hell will break loose. You might have spent a year at home, and the printer doesn't know what you want. God knows the publisher doesn't know what you want. So that only you can tell the printer. And the publisher will discourage this, because it's expensive, and they don't like this alliance between the artist and the printer. But in fact, it isn't expensive. And in fact, the book will look better. And in fact, the printer enjoys working with you. Would like to make you happy, but he doesn't know what kind of red you want, what intensity, what this, what that. The same thing with scenic painting, which is why I got angry with Ted on Dracula, which also was beautiful, but it would have been better had he been there. Because in that translation from picture to set, a whole thing takes place. Could be bedlam if you're not around to see it happen. What looks good this way might look terrible that way. What is an indifferent drawing, bad hand or edge of a skirt, it doesn't matter in a drawing, you blow that up and that's all you can look at on the stage. So you become acutely aware of every inch of your drawing and imagining what it looks like big. It's scary.
What kind of a work process do you use? Do you just create sketches and then let's see what happens with the painters? Or?
Well, no, I'm learning the proper way is to, I do sketches, then I hire an assistant because I don't know anything technically about scale. My mathematics is appalling. So I get some young person who is trained from a college who wants to work with me. He becomes my apprentice and we teach each other. And he takes my drawings, my rough drawings, or she, because I've had both kinds, and builds what we call a white model. Meaning taking my drawings and the assistant translates them very roughly into three dimension in a model in the exact scale of the Houston Grand Opera or the Glyndebourne Opera or the New York City Opera, wherever you're working. Then we actually see very roughly what I look like in three dimension. Then I can change the whole thing if it's dreadful. And then I may have a drawing I like very much, but the assistant says, but Maurice, that looks nice, but you have only 2 feet there between this and that. And this is Don Giovanni, say, and she's going to have a skirt like this. She can't get through, so forget it now. Redesign the whole thing, because she cannot make an entrance and an exit. So before you get to anything vaguely like a finished drawing, you have worked out all the logistics, who's coming from where, what, and when, so that you are not punished later by having to give up a whole scene, which has happened to me too, where you just were not prepared for what was happening. And also you have to be ready that sometimes she isn't wearing a skirt like this at the beginning, but halfway through your designs, when they're half painted, your director suddenly wants her to wear a skirt like this. Well, he comes ahead of you. And he says, that goes. You see that tree up there? Send that out. And you say, why? She didn't have a dress like this 3 months ago. He said, well, she has now. And since he's directing the show, your tree goes out. So you swallow that one. It's a very different problem.
Yeah.
I only know that story. It's a wonderful story. It was at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York where there is a, I don't know what you call it, where they work with autistic children. In fact, it was so startling, they invited me up, the psychiatrist there invited me up to see what I had put into, to show you how naive psychiatrists are, what ingredients I had put into the book to make this child talk. How the hell did I know? It just seemed to me that artists and psychiatrists were all working in different directions towards the same thing in some way. But the story was that she was about 10 or 11, I think. She had never, ever talked. And the story was read to her, and being an uncontrollable child, she grabbed the book away from the reader and said, "That's mine." And those were her first two words. So, of course, I was very gratified. I don't know if she continued to speak. The story is so good, you have to stop it there. Because she may have said something dreadful after that. Let's pick up people who haven't asked yet. Anybody? All right, then people who have. Right. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Zlata the goat. The techniques for Zlata. Well, it's very much in my traditional pen and ink style, which I began in the middle 60s with Higgledy Piggledy Pop, actually, which is a ripoff. My favorite illustrators of that period were Victorian English illustrators, Arthur Hughes, John Everett Millais, Pinwell. There's a whole series of what were called the 60s, the great English 60s illustrators, which I was very enamored of. And they all copied the look of Dura or wood engraving with fine cross-hatched line, pen and ink line. So I began to do it. And Higgledy Piggledy Pop was the first book of that, and the George MacDonald fairy tales I did were that. And the apotheosis, really, was Zlata the Goat, and Juniper Tree was the last book I did in that style. So it's originated there. It's that very finicky. It's fun to work with a pen that way. Noodling work takes forever. And Isaac Singer liked it very much, but he shrugged and in his way said, "It's very nice, but I like it better than color." After slaving for 6 months. I like him anyway. Yeah.
In which media did you do in the night kitchen?
In the night kitchen is tempera and magic marker. The first book I ever used magic marker, and the last. I strongly advise you, do not use magic marker. It's very tempting, but it is such a mess. You can't get it off anything, and it gets over here while you're drawing, and it gets on the printer's hands, and I redid a lot of drawings because of that stupid instrument. Yeah.
Just continuing with that, did you have any trouble with the color itself, or is it mostly because it's such a, because of the permanent?
You mean, oh, the magic marker? I use permanent markers.
Yeah.
Yes, they're undependable, completely undependable.
For watercolor?
Yeah. That was it. Yeah.
I know you love comic strips. Were you ever, as a young man, tempted to go into newspaper syndication?
Oh, sure. I worked, but when I was 16, I got a job for All American Comics, unbeknownst to my parents. It was the end of my scholastic life. And my job was to do the backgrounds to Mutt and Jeff, Tippy and Cap Stubbs, and Captain Midnight. And what I'd do is I'd go uptown and now the comics were laid out for the weekly, which was the one row. And they would give me the one row, and I would have to break it up into a Sunday. The same thing, which means there wasn't enough drawing. So I would have to add drawing on to fill a Sunday page. That's a big job for a 16-year-old, actually. But I loved it, and I learned to draw like Captain Midnight and Tippy and Mutt and Jeff. And I had that job for about 3 years. I earned my own money, and I never did my homework, and I hardly got out of school. But my goal then was to be a comic strip artist or to work for Walt Disney. I besieged him with letters, which needless to say he never answered, about wouldn't he please save me from Brooklyn and bring me to California? So I could do a movie like Pinocchio, which was my favorite, and I think the best animated film ever made in the history of animation. But that was my primary goal, to be a comic book artist.
Did you actually develop some strips?
I developed a strip when I was my last year at high school. I did a comic strip for the newspaper, which is really disappointingly poor. Actually, I wish it were better than it is, but it isn't, considering my experience. It's not funny, and it's not even drawn well. But that was the end of that. It ceased almost on leaving school. That whole interest stopped, partly because I had to get a job. And then I began interested in window displays for a while, because that's what I was doing. And it seemed I was not going to get to do what I wanted to do, which were comic strips or books. It was about a two-year wait there until I could sell my stuff.
Are you still interested in the medium? Do you keep up with it?
No. Tell you the truth, I'm not interested in comic strips at all. I'm sorry to say. But it fell away from me. I've lost, except Little Nemo. Or I love Little Nemo, but Little Nemo is, who could call that a comic strip? Or Prince Valiant, or some of the special ones. The graphics is so spectacular. But that's not real comic strip stuff.
There's so much of that in the night kitchen.
In the Night Kitchen is homage to Winsor McCay and Little Nemo. Absolutely.
Have you been consulted at all as far as the Broadway development of Little Nemo?
No, I haven't. I've heard about it, but no one's called me up. I've written essays on him. One of the best essays I wrote was on Little Nemo and Winsor McCay and what happens to American artists like Winsor McCay, who are one of our few dramatic fantasists. We don't have another one like him. And he took the form of a comic strip. And we're such snobs in this country that we chose to look down our noses at him. The art establishment never gave him the time of day. I mean, he had an exhibition in as late as 1970 or 68 by a very good friend of mine who collected from the original family, from the son of Winsor McCay, the original drawings. Well, no one gave a damn about that show. There's always been a small elitist, fervent group, me among them, of admirers. But he cannot be accepted as a real artist. Why? Because he did a comic strip. Disgraceful, really.
You must be suffering from that, too.
In a way, I'm a kiddie book artist come hell or high water. Yeah. I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, you are pigeonholed forever in that particular category. It is irritating. But then, there are compensations if you're a successful kiddie book illustrator. It is very tiresome, absolutely tiresome to be that. The best review I ever had in my life, the only one I've ever saved, was for The Love for Three Oranges, which was an opera design in England. It got a wonderful review in the English press, and the very last sentence was, "By the way, I hear this man does books for children in America." God bless him. It was the first out of the closet of kiddie bookland. I was somebody else, finally. Strange that we do that kind of thing. Yeah.
You mentioned before that one of the reasons you were thinking vaguely now of writing for the stage is that you could do things that you haven't yet done in books.
Yeah.
Can you say what kind of things?
Well, there are dramatic subjects, all right, that border on the sexual, obviously, that will not be permitted in a book for children. I think they should be. I fervently believe that. And that I could... Even with my present stature, that I could handle it, I could do it discreetly, and I think it must be done, should be done, because it obsesses me, so I think it should obsess other people. But I won't do it. I won't do it because I would put my publisher in a terrible position. They would want to publish it, it would be such an awkward position, it simply isn't worth trying. And the reception, I don't want to go through that. I don't want to read the idiot in the New York Times telling me that I'm a feverish pervert. I don't need to be told that at my age. I know how important my subjects are. I will not be reduced to idiocy by these people. So the hell with it. Use it somewhere else. It's no tragedy. It really isn't. I mean, one has to accept the limitations of these forms, and that's all there is to it. Yeah.
Would you worry about the audience who you are writing?
Not at all. Not at all. I do not think of audience. I never have a single conception of what people are like who are reading my book. I don't. Thank goodness. I mean, what would I do if I did? If you're worried about what people are thinking or how they look or age groups or whatever. No. It's always astonishing, and I mean this genuinely, to be autographing books somewhere and people come over and describing the effects of your book on them. It's wonderful. But it's an astonishing thing that actually they have been reading it, that it's been in the world, and people have been subjected to it or reading it or have been influenced by it. Or think, there's a young man yesterday at the show, I mean, I thought he was going to bite my face off. He says, "You wrote Wild Things, hey man, no, I can't believe it, wow, you wrote Wild Things." You know, and I said, "Are you all right?" Thinking the book had obviously had a bad effect on him. But no, he was just really excited. I mean, he thought I must have died years ago, because if you read something when you were a child, surely that person died. No, it was nice, it was very touching.
Do you have any contact with any of the other authors, like Dr. Seuss or Jay Ray?
Yes. Well, only those I like. Uh-huh. And my best friends in the profession are very few. And one is Dr. Seuss, who I think is just terrific. And he's a wonderful man. And William Steig, who is perhaps my best friend in the world and colleague. But I think Bill Steig's books are fantastic. And anyone... Oh, God. I mean, go to the library, young man. Dominic, Amos and Boris, which is one of the best picture books ever written. All the books by Bill Steig are fantastic. And if you tell Bill he's written a children's book, he looks at you as though you're crazy. I mean, he's a man 70. How could he write a children's book? But he happens to write books which are marvelous. But Tommy Ungerer, who I think wrote some of the best books for children in the 60s, really cuckoo books. But, I mean, really wonderful. He's not, and he's still living, but he's not publishing in America at this point. Very few others, actually.
Do
I know them, but only a few of us are really close friends. And Seuss and I were on a panel together in San Diego only about 6 months ago. He never appears, and just because we like each other, we thought we'd appear together at a museum, and it was wonderful because he comes from a generation of publishing which is very different from mine. He's in his middle to late 70s. He knew what publishing was like in the 30s. I only start in the middle 50s. So there we were talking. We forgot about the audience. We just got so excited about our publishing dilemmas. But he is an extraordinary man.
Is he still writing?
Oh, of course he's still writing. He's writing five books at the same time, always.
Now, his are very different from yours. His are based more on wordplay.
Completely. He is a very... I told him this, and he laughed hysterically, because he's of that generation which has no faith in psychology, thinks it's just the most effete, silly business the way we analyze everything. But that's a certain time in America when there was, they felt that way. And he likes me, but he apologizes for his psychoanalyzing friend. Poor Maurice, he's really okay, despite all these things that he ad nauseum talks about. Just ignore him. He's a good friend, you know. But in particular, I said, somebody in the audience said, why do you like Dr. Seuss books? And here is Dr. Seuss sitting next to me. And I said, well, this man is a revolutionary. I mean, no one in this country has told children to go out and be as fierce as he has done. He's used their language, which most people drives crazy. He's turned it into poetry, that karate chop repetitive, ad nauseum banging sound, which most of us can't bear, even though we love children. He has turned into an art form. And I said, on top of which, and this nearly knocked him out of his chair, I said, he's revolutionary from the point of view that he tells children what they want to hear, which is that really toilet training isn't all that great. And I said, after all, what is most of his books are about? That you make a mess when your parents are gone. The Cat in the Hat exploits children and says, come on, they're gone, go back to the way you were. With luck, you'll clean it up in time and those two dodos won't even know what happened. And he was sitting there and said, Maurice, you're out of your mind, he kept saying. But in fact, because he thinks I'm ludicrously reading into his books, and maybe I am, but I swear that's what I see in that stuff. He even has a fecal quality to his drawings. I said that too, which he wasn't too happy about. But there is that mad, unconscious quality in his work, which is wild, which is why I think it's so funny. And there are very few writers who have done that in this country, who are that funny, and it's curious, he has been completely ignored by the establishment. He has never won an award. Oh, he did win what I just won, the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award, which is, in the trade, we call the Alta Cocker Award. If you live long enough, you will get it. But that's unfair for him, because he should have won every award. He's never won the Newbery, he's never won the Caldecott, he's never won the proper awards that are the awards given to people who deserve it in the profession. And why? I think if people were honest, they would say, well, we don't want to give it to him because he's slightly vulgar, and because he's too popular, he's too rich, his books sell too well. So that's another kind of snobism you run into. Seuss is so popular, is so wealthy, he's so happy to be so wealthy. One of the few people I know who gets pleasure out of owning San Diego, or thinks he owns San Diego. But what's wrong with that? And again, that's too bad, actually. But he doesn't mind. Only I mind for him. Yes?
A lot of artists and writers talk an awful lot about why they create. So if you let me ask you one more question. You say you don't really keep in mind too much the reactions that the people might have. Can I infer from this that you really do it as best for yourself?
Oh, well, sure. There's no other way to infer it. You do indeed do it, and the more successful you become, the more you're encouraged to do it for yourself. I mean, you're given a kind of power, which is, I think, the best thing success and financial security can give you, which is to indulge further these things that once made you timid, so that the books get braver, the books get stronger. I'd like to think that's what's happening. But finally and ultimately, even those who deny that they do it for themselves, because I guess that's supposed to be vainglorious. You should always do everything for everybody else except yourself. But why the hell would you write except for yourself? It's a very torturous business. I mean, solitary confinement for God knows how long. It might as well be for you. Besides, how can you guess who is this you're doing it for, except for the person you're dedicating it to, your dear wife, child, or dog. But fundamentally, it's for you. Yeah.
What type of influence did DC comic books have on you when you grew up? Because I would guess that you read a lot of scales of horror and all those other kinds of things.
EC, I don't know what EC is.
EC comic books, the graphic types that came out just right after the Great War.
That's post me. I mean, post when I would be involved in comic strips. So I don't know them.
You would look.
I'll take your word for it. Yeah.
I'd like to ask a little bit about your animated films. You did do a short version, well, a half-hour version of Frilly Rose. It's not very short for a cartoon. Are you thinking of doing any other work like that? And how did you collaborate with an animator to do that?
Well, we did the one Really Rosy film. No, I will not do another one. It's too expensive. Animation is hopelessly too expensive nowadays. It's too hard. And you're doing it for television, and that's too nauseating. See, it's all negatives there. But in that particular case, I did work with, we opened an animation studio in New York, because we were all New Yorkers, and we didn't want to work in California. And the only one who was California on the project was Carol King. And we did trips to her, to work with her. But the whole thing was supervised as best as possible with me being there all the time during the doing of it. Didn't make it as good as we wanted anyway, but it was watched.
Did you have any kind of sponsor for that, or was that an independent project?
No, we had a sponsor. We had Hershey chocolates, and we had some breath mint, which I just assumed forget about. I guess after you eat the Hershey's, you take the breath mint.
But I also wanted to ask you, you were talking before about sort of subtle but definitely sexual things expressed in your books. Do you feel outside over there is like the story of the mother and that, you know, the fact of the father leaving and the younger daughter having to sort of take over her role seems to be that to me.
That book is devilishly sexual, let me tell you. Devilishly and deviously, because it can't be openly.
Yeah,
but what I've packed into that is appalling. But it sure got to get said. It had to get said by me. And it had to do with largely the predominance of the powerful females in my family, both my mother and my sister. So that book is so clever, it gives me great pleasure, because it's never going to be discovered. It's nice to be able to pack it in and tell a story over the whole thing. But it's all to do, I'm not going to tell you what it's all to do, but except in a simplistic way, it's all to do with the memory of being a little boy surrounded by the all-powerful female mystery. Now, how common this was in Jewish families and middle class, I don't know. I suspect probably. I don't want to be crude here. But my sister's period was something both my brother and I were intensely jealous of. It was an incredible mystery. One, she was allowed to smoke during that time. So in my mind, that period in the woman's life is connected with camels or Paul Mall or whatever. She also was allowed the room to herself. We all shared the same room. During that strange, enigmatic time, she had the room to herself. We were furious that nothing like this could happen to us ever. So that's only a vulgar moment, but the whole aura that was conveyed by my mother about the mystery is something I had to deal with in Outside Over There. Not as a grown-up man, but back to being a child again. And what was it? What did it look like? What did it smell like? What was it that puzzled, aggravated, and teased me? That was never clearly explained, ever clearly explained. I mean, my sister's period only meant the door shut and smoke coming out from the bottom of the door. God knows what was going on inside. that's in the book. That was a very important part of my life to figure out.
Yes,
indeed. That's good. I'm glad you brought that up. Because, well, did it have anything to do with the magic flute outside over there? Because both were coinciding projects. Very much. Tremendous influence. I think it's one of the most, the best coincidence of my life. That when the book was beginning is when the magic flute offered itself. The offer came, and I agreed to do it, and then a calamity occurred. It was going to be a collaboration between the Houston Grand Opera and the Washington Opera. And the money depended on both opera companies coming through. So I was all ready to postpone my book and go plunge into the magic flute. And then the Washington Opera backed out. They just couldn't. And it was a terrible blow because it was over. I didn't know that it was going to be picked up 2 years later. To me, it was over. And Frank apologized, and that's the way the opera world was, and I had to get used to it. Maybe we do it someday, but I didn't believe it. To me, it was the best thing that just got blown I just couldn't bear it. But since I had worked myself up into a passion already, I turned back to outside over there, and boy, did I give it the magic flute. I have no place else to go with the magic flute at this point. So even her name, Ida, is a derivative of Pamina. Mozart is in the book, but more important than the obvious things like names and images was the character of Ida took on some of what I thought was the character of Pamina. Because Mozart, I'm not going to give you a lecture, I swear, on Mozart, except for one tiny thing, which is he's one of the few geniuses in the world who, as early as the 18th century, made women very important. I mean, Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro, and especially Pamina in The Magic Flute, are heroic. It's very, very uncommon stuff for the 18th century. People complain about The Magic Flute because there's so much derogatory discussion of women in it, like they chatter and they're foolish, but they don't stop to see that the hero of the opera is a young woman. She is allowed to become a Freemason, which is amazing. Mozart was a serious Freemason. And it's marvelous in that at the beginning of the opera, she is a thoroughly confused young woman. Is her mother wicked? Is her mother psychotic? Is her mother good? We don't know. She is kidnapped into Zoroastro's kingdom. Is he good? Is he bad? Will she be raped? Won't she be raped? Is Monostatos good? Is he evil? So it is really the story of a young adolescent girl just coming into puberty who doesn't know what's right or what's wrong or who's good or who's bad. And then comes the wonderful Tamino, the prince who loves her. And she has to learn through this opera that her mother, in fact, is psychotic, that her mother, in fact, will see her dead if she doesn't kill Zoroastro. And it becomes a symptom story or a metaphor for adolescence, for growing up. So that at the end of the opera, it is so touching when Tamino is supposed to be the hero of the opera, and they go through the trials of fire and water, and he breaks down, and she sings the loveliest phrase in the entire opera, which is, "Put your hand on my shoulder, and my love will see you through." She's come a long way from the hysteric of Act One to this glorious woman who is leading him through. And she says, "Life's path is strewn with the thorn of roses." It's a marvelous, marvelous thing. And I took my cue from that, in that Ida, who is faced with a terrible dilemma, how do you live with a somewhat indifferent mother, a father who is away seemingly forever, but who writes letters saying, "I love you," but he ain't there, and a tedious sister who has to be taken care of. Why should she be burdened by this child? It's a confusion and a dilemma that has to be resolved because she's not crazy. She does love the baby. She loves her mother and father. But like children occasionally who are confronted with an exceptional dilemma, what do you do? And at a certain moment, she loses every bit of giving a damn and just wishes that baby dead. Stone cold dead, like ice babies are. And then to her horror, her wish comes true. But it's only a fantasy, like the juniper tree and the fairy tales. It isn't really dead. You only wish the dead. But being a child, the wish is as bad as the fact. And it is so for children. The wish is as bad as the fact. So she then goes out, breaks her back, redeeming herself and saving her baby sister. So at the end of the book, she has come a long way through that path, the way I felt Pamina had come through the opera. So Mozart became the God figure for me, so that at the end of the book, when she is carrying her baby sister home safe, there is Mozart sitting by the edge of the stream writing the magic flute. Now, some people said, "Oh, isn't that cute and conceitful of you?" Well, screw them. I mean, he had saved my life through that book, and it seemed only right that he get the credit for it, however conceitful it seemed to other people. So those two projects really did coincide. And then just when I finished that damn book, Houston Grand Opera took up the entire sum of money and did the magic flute. So I had them both.
Thank you.
Welcome. Yeah.
You say you pack a lot into these books, and you say a lot of people read things in that aren't there. Are these things that you put in things that you think people will be able to pick out?
I don't know. I really don't know that. There are things that I wish they would pick out. There are things that I think are simple enough to pick out, and they usually do.
Are there other things that one would have to see it from your angle?
Yes. And there are some things, frankly, in some books that are blatantly and belligerently and hostily hidden. Just for the fun of it. Yeah.
Yourself, do you have some kind of sense of social responsibility? two powerful women figures that were in your life. Well, resolving that, you know, against traditional role of women in society, I mean, do you feel you had some kind of an obligation
yeah.
to write that?
Yeah, I mean, if you're just going to write about your personal obsession, who gives a damn? I mean, you have to paint a background to your personal obsessions. They have to have a point. And since I do care about children, and I do care about myself, I consider myself reasonably intelligent and ethical, that I'm not going to hoist or foist, whatever is the word, my obsessions on anybody unless they fit into some elemental thing which works as a work of art. You have no right to do it unless you can make it a work of art. So it isn't enough to have been worried about your mother and sister. You've got to fit that into something else. The way it isn't enough for Mozart to have worried about whether Pamina was going to live or die, except within the framework of her life according to these men, mothers, scene, whatever. I mean, that's the obligation of the artist.
Well, what about, since, all right, then that's kind of what I was just going to ask you, since you become an established artist, how do you feel, I mean, do you have any kind of social commitments? Do you work outside your art?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I mean, there is now a program of illustrators to stop nuclear action. I mean, we're all doing what we can without too much hope. Yeah.
Did you consciously choose children as a way to go through manifesting those emotions and things that you wanted to get through? Because they see things more directly, and do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I didn't consciously choose children as models. I think it was just natural to me, or maybe I felt still that way. Or I had trouble growing up or something. But that it still seemed to me that way to me, as nebulous and uncertain. And I suspect it is that way to most grown-ups, were they just to admit it, that what is this thing called grown-up? Oh, there are certain things. There are experience and stuff and stuff and stuff and stuff. But to me, there are still the same quirky little problems that have existed all my life that I wouldn't dare mention in polite society. Little things I don't know about the body, for instance. I don't know who to ask anymore because I'm supposed to be so old I should know. And certain things that happen that I don't understand, but that I've never understood. And no amount of living has quite clarified for me. But I can't think that that's particular to me. I hope not. Yeah.
Now,
I don't do this. I don't do a circuit, no, and I do this very, very infrequently. Probably because I wanted to be here. I like to teach, and I've missed teaching because I've not been able to teach because of my present work, which keeps me traveling, so I can't hold a teaching schedule.
Where are you teaching?
Well, I taught at, I gave a workshop at Yale many years ago, and in New York at Parsons. And I think, thank you for your compliment about how I'm dealing with questions here, but partly it comes from the pleasure of talking to students, which I like very much. And which I've missed terribly. And you kind of build up a lot of energy when you're home by yourself painting a lot of pictures, watching crappy television. It's nice to talk seriously about your work to people who are interested in your work or interested seriously in the business of art. It's nice.
Are you invited a lot to speak?
I'm invited a lot to speak, but I rarely accept. It's exhausting. And you pick and choose the places you want to go to. I don't go to ladies' clubs or men's clubs or Kiwanis things or nothing like that. And I also will not speak at libraries. I will not be nosed in on just children's book subjects. I think that's too reductive. I refuse to speak to children because they're always disappointed. And it's just, I mean, you have to be a vaudeville actor for children. They want to be amused. They don't believe you're the man who did their favorite book. And if you are, who gives a damn? And they say things like, he's too short anyway. Well, they say quite devastating things, and you can't hit children, especially if you're in my business. So you have to do something else with children, which I really don't have the knack of doing. I can't entertain children. So that I limit my speaking to almost to the point where I don't do it at all. But I like to do it.
Maybe we should stop
that. Okay, I'm stopping. Thank you very much.